Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, is the Federal Reserve really ready to end its stimulus program, and what does that mean for you?
But first, protesters turned out today at the first hearing on Capitol Hill to discuss President Obama's plan to fight ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Protesters chanting, even as airstrikes have already expanded. No more war from members of the anti-war group Code Pink. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and Army General Martin Dempsey are answering questions from senators on the Armed Services Committee. Juana Summers is a congressional reporter for NPR. She's on Capitol Hill. And Juana, just briefly, we are familiar with the sight of Code Pink anti-war protesters, but they seem now some of the few voices we're hearing against any action against ISIS. Were there many of them today?
There were quite a number of them. If you listen through this hearing, as I have been doing for the last couple of hours, they've been stopping. And Senator Levin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Democrat of Michigan, has had to stop and say, you know, please don't disrespect the freedom of speech that we have here, this free space. And a number have been escorted from the room. Not an uncommon thing for hearings where the Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff show up. But it does seem to be a little bit more prevalent, actually, than it has in the past couple of hearings I've witnessed.
Well, let's get to some of the concerns. The president has said repeatedly there will be no U.S. troops on the ground in a combat role in any strikes on ISIS. There are 1,000 advisors in Iraq, but at the hearings today, General Dempsey reiterated the plan is for them to just help Iraqi troops with planning and logistics. But then he said this.
If we reach the point where I believe our advisors should accompany Iraq troops on attacks against specific ISIL targets, I'll recommend that to the president.
Juana, what was the reaction from senators to that?
You know, he was pressed on this a little bit more, and General Dempsey then said, you know, under certain circumstances, he could go back to the president and make a recommendation that ground forces be included. There's been a lot of consternation on Capitol Hill about this idea of so-called no boots on the ground, a phrase used by a number of those in the administration, a number of Democrats. They're saying, you know, there already are boots on the ground. What General Dempsey's doing here is making a distinction between advisors and combat troops who are actually engaging in hostilities. But I think that for some Republican lawmakers, even some Democrats who are a little wary here, that's probably not enough.
Well, the Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has been pushing for a bigger military response, including ground forces. And here's an exchange he had.
What if they tell us we're not going to do anything other than maybe drop a few bombs? Would you consider the recommendation to the president that allowing ISIL to maintain a safe haven in Syria and to grow in capability over time is a major threat to the United States? Could you envision yourself recommending to the president, if nobody else will help us, that we go in on the ground and clean these guys out in Syria?
I don't think that even if we were to go in and on the ground, armored divisions with flags furled,
the full weight of the military,
I don't think we would do anything more than push this problem further to the right.
Well, in fact, Senator Carl Levin of Michigan asked a little bit about that as well. Let's just listen to a little bit more from today's hearings. He asked if the idea behind using forces that are Syrian and Iraqi on the ground instead of Western was to avoid a Western ground force in an Arab country. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel had this response.
This is not a West versus East issue. This is not a U.S.-European coalition against Muslim countries. It's important that the world see, especially the people of the Middle East see, that the threat that is confronting them first and all of us needs to be addressed by the people of their region as well as all nations and all people in the world.
Juana Summers, this seems to be the theme.
It does. This idea of coalition building is incredibly important. We've heard that from a number of people within the administration, as well as Republicans and Democrats who sit on the relevant committees in Congress. they're saying that, you know, there's going to be a lot more buy-in if Congress can show bipartisan support for some kind of resistance against ISIS, against these so-called Islamic militants. And it's just a matter of seeing how that actually comes down. Right now, we're not seeing much organized resistance to the president's request for authority.
Yeah. And Juana, today, Secretary Hagel, we understand, used the word war in describing attacks on ISIS. This has, of course, been pretty contentious, you know, the use of the word war. Your thoughts on it today?
This has been rather contentious, and to my knowledge, this is the first time I've heard this described as a war, and the fact that that's coming from Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is rather significant. You know, a lot of people are saying you don't want a war vote for members of Congress. They're looking at leaving by the end of this week until after the midterm elections, and if you're heading back to your district, the last thing you want to be talking about right now is a war vote. So I think this is a really significant statement, both looking at U.S. foreign policy as well as looking at the politics playing out here on Capitol Hill.
Well, we have heard some spokespeople types use the word war, but couch it in saying it's war on ISIS in the same way we're in a war with al-Qaeda. Did he couch it as well?
It has been a little bit couched, and just to reiterate quickly, if you listen to General Martin Dempsey, he said that, you know, this is not going to be a shock and awe campaign. So what we're seeing right now from the United States is not the same as what we saw back in 2003 with engagement in Iraq.
Yeah. NPR's Juana Summers on Capitol Hill. She's been listening in on hearings, the first to consider President Obama's plan for striking ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Juana, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, not far from the Capitol, there is another important meeting going on at the Federal Reserve today. It is a two-day meeting that will end with a closely watched announcement tomorrow, and it'll give us some more details about the Fed's plans to end its bond-buying economic stimulus program known as quantitative easing. It was put in place about 6 years ago to prop up a collapsing U.S. economy, but as soon as next month, the Fed is expected to stop pumping billions of dollars a month into the economy. So what does that mean for all of us? Diane Swank is chief economist at Mesirow Financial. She's with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Diane, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, and what are you expecting from the Fed tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow the job of the chair's job is to really lay out the argument for gradualism. The Fed is moving from providing a lot of stimulus to the U.S. economy to still stimulating the U.S. economy. They expect to continue to keep their balance sheet constant. So anything that matures off their balance sheet, they're going to fill it up and buy again to keep their balance sheet constant at a very high level, about $4.5 trillion. It's amazing how we jump from B's to T's over the last 6 years. But, you know, to keep that balance sheet constant and then begin the process in thinking about how they exit, their exit strategy, which is to gradually, and I underscore, slowly, gradually raise rates. Now, not everybody on the Fed has agreed about that, but the core of the Fed that supports Chair Yellen, is there. The majority of the Fed is there. We'll hear some noise from people who would like to do it sooner. The Federal Reserve is really sort of, they're in a position where there's been a lot of examples historically of central banks coming out of a financial crisis and moving too soon. And they've seen the disasters from that. So they're trying to get the lessons from history and hedge the downside. What they don't know is what happens if they move too slow. They think the risk of that is less than the risk of maybe pushing the U.S. economy back into a recession, which
but of
is
course,
not what they want to
accomplish. Well, there's no precedent for winding down something like this. Should Americans be concerned that they might be sent back into a recession if the Fed pulls out too quickly?
I think this Fed is really going to be cautious to not pull out too quickly, and that's what the Americans should be reassured that the Fed is concerned about that, and certainly that's where they're hedging their bets. That said, this is a difficult time, and we're, like you said, we're in uncharted territory, and the Fed's trying to avoid the thin ice, but how do you know if you're avoiding the thin ice or not if it's covered up with snow? We just don't know. And so the uncertainty going forward, and that's why the Fed's treading so carefully in this process, is because they are worried, because they don't want to make the wrong decision. They don't want to make the wrong decision for the economy, for the American public. And they really, there is a sense within the core of the Fed, and there are some people who don't agree with this, but the majority of the Fed really believes not only do we need to get back to where we were on sort of aggregate measures, but we need catch up here. And, you know, the aggregates cover what the majority of Americans are feeling, and that is that they're more confident than they were during the crisis, but they've lost ground. The majority of Americans have lost income relative to where they were prior to the crisis. The majority of Americans have less net worth than they did prior to the crisis. These are the things that the Fed is trying to sort of look at and say, can we allow a little catch-up as well?
Well, and this is not happening in a vacuum. As we just heard a few moments ago, there's a hearing on Capitol Hill today about the president's plan to combat ISIS. We've got the situation in Ukraine continuing. What do you see as the biggest risks to the economy right now?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that I think are important. Geopolitical risks are, of course, number one. The situation in Ukraine, although somewhat quiet, we know that it flares at any moment. And what does it mean for the rest of Europe? Europe is struggling, really. And Germany, although is the stronger performing economy, has some underlying weakness as well. And so can Europe get out of this? This is very important. This is all at the same time that we're looking at. Last year, we saw what we call the taper tantrum. Interest rates went up when the Fed was just thinking about doing what they're going to do in October. And in response to that, the housing market is still not back to where it was a year ago. And that's something the Fed really sort of – that not only do we have these external shocks where the rest of the world is still precarious with geopolitical and economic risks, but also the internal fragility. We have some self-sustaining momentum, but it's not broad-based. It's incredibly uneven. And the interest rate sensitivity that you'd think interest rates as low as they are today, and they've come back down, that the housing market isn't even where it was a year ago, that shows the Federal Reserve that there's still some underlying problems with the U.S. economy and a lot of healing to go.
And we should be clear, by the way, that the Fed has two mandates. They're concerned about inflation and they're concerned about employment. They're going for full employment. What is full employment, do you think, in 2014? What are they aiming for right now, Diane?
You know, the goal of the Fed, because the overall unemployment rate no longer is a great summary measure because a lot of people have just dropped out or given up or need to be reengaged. A lot of those are younger people who can't afford to stay out forever and they're going to come back. With the Federal Reserve, the bottom line is wage gains. Janet Yellen, at the end of the day, if you want one statistic that she's going to be watching, it's wages. We need to see an acceleration in wages, and we need to see an acceleration in wages that actually feeds a little inflation, because right now they're running a little cool on inflation too. And they'd even be willing to have the economy run a little hotter than it has been, because it's been undershooting inflation for a while, if it meant more catch up for people to actually earn a little more. And, you know, we're not talking about runaway inflation. We're talking about the Fed sort of allowing the economy to let the party get going finally. I mean, this is a Fed that wants to spike the punch and pay the band extra and get more people out on the economic dance floor participating in this economy rather than on the sidelines.
And Robin just started dancing over on the other side of the studio here.
Spiking the punch.
Diane Swong, chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York said Congress may hold hearings to look at violence on the part of NFL players, several of whom have been charged with domestic abuse or child abuse. Well, today we want to look at how the sports media is handling this story. On Sunday, ESPN anchor Hannah Storm concluded an hour-long special with an emotional monologue. She said as a mother, she's had to answer seemingly impossible questions from her daughters after the video surfaced of Ravens star Ray Rice decking his fiancée. Why did he do that, they asked. Why isn't he in jail? And then,
what does all of this mean for the future? What does it mean for female fans whose dollars are so coveted by the NFL, who make up an estimated 45% of the NFL's fan base? Are fans and our families, are we as parents supposed to compartmentalize everything that's happening? Are we supposed to simply separate a violent game on the field from violent acts off the field? And if we do, what message does that send?
David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent. He joins us now. And David, these networks have multi-billion-dollar partnerships with the NFL. You know, it's one thing for TMZ, the tabloid site, to release videos, but this strikes us as pretty extraordinary. How about you?
Well, I think that's right. I think the TMZ tapes has really expanded the playing field of what's acceptable to cover, not just in some of the investigative work, but in some of the more mainstream programs. Think of the role not only that ESPN plays. Businessweek estimates its average payment to the NFL is about $1.9 billion to broadcast football games. But also Hannah Storm is a straight down the line kind of football presenter. She presented herself, I think, fairly as a fan, somebody who cares about the game, not as, you know, an opiner, an opinion maker like Keith Olbermann or if you think of Stephen A. Smith, people who are expected to be outspoken. This really is going right down the middle, and people are finding that they need to talk about this.
Well, but they're also challenging football fans many of whom are supporting these players. Last Thursday, CBS devoted the first 25 minutes of the pregame show to analysis of the Ray Rice situation. And you have anchor James Brown challenging the NFL community and all men to confront the problem of domestic violence.
Our language is important. For instance, when a guy says, you throw the ball like a girl or you're a little sissy, it reflects an attitude that devalues women. And attitudes will eventually manifest in some fashion.
And that was the first game in which they also took a Rihanna song off the plan for the evening because, of course, she'd been a victim of domestic abuse. And so some people are asking, is this sincere or is this the NFL feeling it has to do something because of the events?
Well, let's be clear. There's the league itself, the NFL, and then there are the broadcast networks. You know, journalists, as an old political editor of mine once say, know which way the wind's blowing as well as anybody else. They can read a poll as well as anybody else. The TMZ video, as we talked about last week, really changed the equation. It was so visceral, so visual. And you see broadcasters and sports journalists taking a stand in ways they really haven't in years past, even with similar fact patterns about previous assault incidents involving players. And I think what you're seeing here is that the league isn't objecting, not because it doesn't fear the repercussions, but because it can't resist the waves of public protest. And you're seeing the league itself take steps, hire, you know, people who have advocated for changes in legislation to help them lobby in Washington and figure out a path forward.
We just have a few seconds, but do you think it lasts? Do you think football becomes a place where you start hearing about social issues?
I think these are episodic and in waves. You know, the question of concussions and coverage of that, you know, people said, well, football is a place where violence occurs on the field. We kind of expect it. This is outside the realm of play. People didn't expect this to be so much in their living rooms. TMZ changed the equation. And as a result, you've seen these other news outlets that also have these financial partnerships with the league yield to the logic and say, we have to cover this too.
NPR's David Folkenflik. Thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, here's a tough question. When you were 14 years old, did you know what kind of job you wanted when you entered the workforce? That question now requires an answer from thousands of Texas middle school students. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee explains why.
10 eighth graders are skipping homeroom at Burbank Middle School in North Houston. They're sitting in front of computers in a lab.
So, you know, I need your eyes either on me or up here.
Counselor Danette Maldonado is trying to get them ready for high school by asking a really big question. What do you want to be when you grow up? This isn't a career fair. It's a new requirement for high school in Texas.
You're kind of going to pick your plan of study, and you pick it based on your interests and what careers you have in mind at this very young, tender age in your life.
That plan of study is called an endorsement. It's like a high school major. Some other states, including Georgia and Mississippi, also have students choose career pathways. In California, it's optional. Here in Texas, it impacts what kids study in high school, if they're on track for college, and potentially their future job. So Maldonado tries to get these kids to think about the big picture. It's a hard sell. So she hams it up as she reviews a career test.
Oh, wow, these are all the kind of jobs I can do because I'm conventional? Ooh, cost estimators. Ooh, finance. Ooh, hospitality and beauty. Oh.
Well, geez, how does a 14-year-old know what they want to do?
That's Republican State Representative Dan Huberty. He helped write this new education plan. He's quick to point out students can change their minds at least through 10th grade. He says it's not about deciding the rest of their life.
We're trying to get the kids engaged in their own education. We're trying to get the parents engaged and making sure that the counselors are making sure they're getting the right education. And we do that by talking to the students and saying, what interests you?
Back at Burbank Middle School in North Houston, 14-year-old Mario Carrizales is exploring architecture on a career quiz. His counselor, Danette Maldonado, goes over the results with him.
What about knowledge and skills? What do you got to be good at? Active listening, listen to your customers, what they want. So these are some of the important abilities you need to have. Can you visualize something?
Mario likes to draw, work on computers, and he's interested in trucks. But high school, not so much.
I don't know, I just want to go through high school already. Just get it done.
Mario is the kind of kid the lawmaker Huberty wants to reach. Get him interested in school. Get him thinking about his future. But others worry about kids picking a career track so early on. Bob Sanborn is with the advocacy group Children at Risk.
Unfortunately, a lot of freshmen have no idea what they want to do with their life. And sometimes as freshmen, you just say, well, what's the easiest thing to do? And you do that.
Students now have more choices to study areas where industry says they need workers to grow the economy. Think vocational school for jobs like welding, auto technology, and computer coding. Sanborn worries that kids who are smart enough for college will get channeled away from higher education, especially students of color and low-income students.
But I don't think we need to divert children who should be going to college now into technical education just because they're brown and black and are low-income.
Sanborn says as a teenager, he would never have picked a college track because his own parents didn't go to college. He ended up earning an Ivy League PhD. Other educators say the new career paths won't track students because the students choose what to do. Lupita Hinojosa is a school administrator in Spring, a suburb north of Houston.
It is a self-selection. It's about the students and their parents being aware of the options and selecting what they're interested for their child to study.
Hinojosa says the Texas Education Agency is committed to monitoring which students end up in different career pathways to ensure that schools don't limit future opportunities for kids. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
And it's expected to be the biggest initial public offering in Wall Street history. I'm talking about the Chinese e-commerce site Alibaba, which is on track to go public on Friday. Kara Swisher, co-founder and executive editor at the tech news site Recode, is with us from KQED in San Francisco to talk more about it. And Kara, the hype has been building.
Huge.
Is the company worth the hype?
Well, it's going to be financially worth the hype. I think there's a huge demand for these shares, and Wall Street's sort of falling all over itself to buy into the IPO because they think it's going to go up further.
And we've heard a lot about Alibaba over the last several weeks as this has built up to this date. I know that you know the founder of the company,
very well.
Jack Ma.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about him and his vision for the company.
Well, we've interviewed him several times on stage. We've had him a lot. I met him when Yahoo first started investing in Alibaba many years ago in the mid-2000s. He's very persistent. He's all the qualities of an entrepreneur you'd see in Silicon Valley, which was unusual in China at the time. Hugely persistent, just drives through problems very quickly. He has a very large team that's been with him for a long time, which I think is unusual, a little like Netflix, Reed Hastings and things like that. And he just won't take no for an answer. He's very much and very enthusiastic. And he's built a culture that's like that, sort of this can-do culture in China, which, again, was unusual at the time, although there's plenty of companies like that now.
Is there a sense, though, that the IPO would change the company?
Well, he was already wealthy. They had taken parts of the company public before and then went private again. This is a really interesting company in terms of what's happened to it. Alibaba.com was public and then went private. So they've already been very wealthy, but this is a quantum level of wealth that they'll have. And, you know, it's spread out among a lot of people because there's a lot of people running that company because it's so vast. But it certainly will be an interesting question of what it will do with all this money. I think that's the big question I have. Will it start buying globally? They say the market's big enough in China, but, you know, they've got to have ambitions outside of China. They've been buying into U.S. companies, in stakes in U.S. companies. So we'll see what happens in terms of what they're going to do with it and what kind of influence they'll have in this country. And there'll be regulatory issues around that because they're a Chinese company. There'll be questions around that. But it's really the first Chinese company to become a global leader, I think, in the online space.
And are there concerns from any investors that you've heard from about getting into this Chinese company, given that some Chinese companies that people have invested in the past have turned out to not be what they thought they were?
Well, this is much more. I mean, yes, the opaqueness of China is and what happens with the government and when government steps in. There is that element there when things happen there. Yes, I've heard some investors talk about the opaque nature of what's going on there. That said, you know, they're a relatively transparent company compared to many companies in China. And they do have what they've done fascinatingly here in this country, they've set up offices here. They've hired a lot of Americans in their communications department. They're trying very hard to sort of assuage Wall Street's worries in that area.
Now, we know one company that's going to be watching this very closely is Yahoo, which owns about 22% of Alibaba.
Something
what does
like
this
that.
Mean yep. for Yahoo?
Well, it owned a lot more. It owned about 40% at one point, right, and was forced to sell it, forced to sell part of it. And it's being forced to sell some of the shares, less than they had to. So they're going to go down to about 16% in this environment, in this sale, in this particular transaction. You know, it's great for Yahoo. It's the thing that's been keeping Yahoo shares alive. Yahoo, even as Alibaba's gotten powerful and done an amazing performance, Yahoo's performance has declined rather precipitously, including under Marissa Mayer. The core business is really suffering. And so what's happened is they become almost like an Asian investment company. Their shares in SoftBank, and which is a Japanese company, and in Alibaba have kept the shares very high, quite lofty.
Well, we'll be watching Friday, the big IPO of Alibaba. Kara Swisher, co-founder and executive editor at the tech news site Recode. Thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
There are just 2 days left until Scotland's referendum on independence. British Prime Minister David Cameron today signed a pledge promising Scots extensive new powers, including the power to raise taxes if they remain part of the United Kingdom. But polls remain split. On the program yesterday, we heard from a Scottish singer who is very much against independence, and he sings about it.
Never liked to gamble. I've seen what that can do. I believe in right and wrong, I think that you do too. If we stay together, we can keep each other strong. So let's stand together, that's where we belong.
Well, today we have a bagpiper who is very much for independence. Andrew Clark is a member of the Lomond and Clyde Pipe Band, which won the Scottish National Pipe Band Championships last year. He's with us from Glasgow. Andrew, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, tell us why you want out. Why you want out of this union with England?
Well, the main overarching reason is that it's based on the hope that putting power in the hands of Scottish people can offer us a more progressive and a more equal future than is available in the current system within the United Kingdom.
But aren't you worried about the consequences of that you would lose potentially the pound, that some of your big financial institutions could leave Scotland, that there is uncertainty over pensions and healthcare and things like that?
Well, a lot of those stories have come from the very negative no campaign, and most of them have been disproved by experts, independent experts. Scotland can continue to use the pound. No government owns the pound. It's a nationally used currency. It was used before Scotland became part of the United Kingdom. And Professor Lawrence White, who works at Oxford University, actually commented that not having a lender of last resort can actually be a positive thing, because it can prevent banking crises, much like the one that we've seen in 2008, because banks are less likely to act recklessly and take undue risks when they know there's no bailout facility there for them.
But what about the idea that the banks would leave? Lloyds and RBS have said that they would leave Scotland if you go for independence. That's not a rumor. That's what they've said.
They didn't say that they'd leave Scotland. They said that they would move their headquarters to London.
Right.
What that essentially means is that the brass plaque, the name of RBS, would be registered in London. And the head of RBS said in a staff email that was sent out that it wouldn't change any operations and would not lead to any job losses in Scotland. This is part of the fear-mongering that's really been accelerated over the last couple of weeks as the polls have narrowed. The Westminster establishment is really using every dirty trick in the book to try and scare Scottish people away from a future of hope.
So you think this is all scaremongering, that there would be no negative consequences for you as a Scot if you were to go independent?
Everything that I've read from academic experts and experts in various fields has said only the positive things about what possibilities there are for an independent Scotland, because this is a political campaign. As you know, throughout political campaigns, politicians lie, politicians manipulate the truth to suit their own agenda, and that's what we're seeing, and it's been led and supported really by a very hostile media in Scotland, including the BBC, which I'm currently sitting in, who have been promoting the fear-mongering stories led by the Better Together campaign, the No campaign.
Well, what about the new promises from the Prime Minister, David Cameron, that there would be new powers granted to Scotland if it were to stay within the UK?
Well, it's very easy to say that you can offer someone more powers, but Interestingly enough, we haven't been told what these powers would be. We haven't been told when we would receive these powers. And this is a campaign that's been going on for the best part of 2 years. They had the opportunity to offer these powers a long time ago. In fact, there was a cry from the Yes campaign that they wanted a third option on the ballot that would offer maximum devolution, that would guarantee Scotland more powers. And David Cameron rejected that and said that he would not offer that on a ballot paper. So suddenly he's changed his mind and he said that he will offer us more powers. He's not told us what they are. And why would you accept more powers when you can take all power? Why would you settle for what is essentially a mystery box of a promise of more powers when the people of Scotland can take full control of their country into their own hands?
When Americans hear this, I think some of them think to themselves, this is like if Texas or California or some other state decided that it wanted to leave the Union and that you would lose a lot by doing that. Is there a difference in your mind between what Scotland is trying to do here and if Florida decided it wanted out and wanted to go on its own?
Well, I think there's a massive difference because America's got a far more sophisticated federal system than what we experience in Scotland just now. States do exercise a substantial level of power over tax and over education, which we are currently denied. But there's also the Union of Parliaments in 1707. 1,700 years previous of that, Scotland was an independent country. So there's an identity aspect to that. Scotland isn't a region, it isn't a state of the UK, it is a nation.
Now, I know that some of your fellow band members don't agree with you on this.
No, well, Loughnane and Clyde Pipe Band and throughout the pipe band community is really a microcosm of Scottish society. Scottish society is alive with political discussion just now, and there are disagreements. There are, within my own band, there are many people that fundamentally oppose independence, support the union, and there's just the same amount, if not more, that support independence. It's a really exciting time to be engaged in politics. There's great discussion, there's great debate, and for the most part, it's been carried out in a very friendly and positive manner.
Well, I know that you were willing to play some bagpipe music for us, but that the studio, because bagpipes are so loud, the studio can't handle it because the microphones, things could happen. So we do have a little bit of sound, though, that we can play, and I want to hear this tune. This is called Kilworth Hills. Now, Andrew, I know that this is a retreat march, but you are not retreating on independence, it sounds like.
Not in the slightest. I approached the debate as an undecided voter. I wasn't a confirmed yes until I went out and did the research myself. But now that I have done that research and I've went beyond the mainstream media and read the independent experts, for me, my mind is firmly towards a yes vote.
Andrew Clark, a member of the Lomond and Clyde Pipe Band, joining us from Glasgow, Scotland. And as you hear there, he is a firm yes for independence. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Jeremy.
You can't talk about the best songwriters and not include him. That's what Bob Dylan once said about Jesse Winchester, who died this year at the age of 69. The tributes poured in, but perhaps the greatest ever paid came earlier, in 2009, during an episode on Spectacle, the TV show hosted by Elvis Costello. Jesse Winchester sat on a stool. Next to him, Nico Case, then Elvis Costello and Sheryl Crow. And Jesse played one of his best-known songs, Shamaling Dong Ding, the story of a memory of young love. Oh, oh, oh,
oh, oh, oh. The boys will sing in Shamaling, the summer night we met. You were 10 and 17, oh, how could I forget?
You can hear a pin drop. You can see Elvis Costello gobsmacked. He said as much later. You can see a single tear trickle silently down Nico Case's face. The video went viral. 2 years later, Jesse was diagnosed with cancer. Fans thought he'd recovered when he suddenly died this year. But he left an album. It's being released posthumously. We now want to bring in the man who wrote the liner notes.
I want a job. It's not too demanding. Like where? Got to
That's Jimmy Buffett covering Jesse Winchester's A Gentleman of Leisure. As we said, Jimmy wrote the liner notes for Jesse's final CD. It's called A Reasonable Amount of Trouble. And Jimmy Buffett joins us from his studio. When you hear this music and Jesse Winchester's voice, what are you thinking?
I miss him. I started as a complete fan of his music. We had kind of similar Mississippi roots, and we had played one show at a music festival in Jackson that actually somebody sent me a video of later, because to be quite honest, I'd forgotten about it. But many years later, I went to see him in Montreal. But I'd always been a huge admirer of his work and had covered quite a few songs.
Well, you know, to explain a couple of things you just said, he was someone who had roots in Tupelo, Mississippi, and Memphis, but he was in Montreal, he was in Canada, because he was a draft resister.
Yeah.
In 1966, he left, when the Vietnam War was heating up, and didn't come back until he was pardoned. He and others were pardoned by then President Carter. And so people had to make pilgrimages to go see him. What's the draw of the voice and the things that he was writing about?
I think that his clarity of simple songs that just went, right into your heart, not necessarily into your ears when you first heard it. And I'd always also love the fact that he had a great sense of humor about himself.
Yeah, I'm still doing the rumba, baby. I can't seem to quit. If my mama catches us doing the rumba, mama would just pitch a fit, but I can't help myself. It's much bigger than me. If I were you, I'd hang on to a rumba man like me.
When he did come back, Rolling Stone called him his voice the greatest of the decade, which is saying a lot for that decade of the 70s. And people like you, you've said you were hearing him sing about places like Biloxi, the Gulf Coast, that's your territory. And you were saying, wait a minute, who's this guy? Let's listen to a little of his song, Biloxi.
Yeah.
The boy will fill his pail with salt and water. And the storms will blow from off towards New Orleans.
Jimmy Buffett, we know Jesse Winchester came to play for a concert you were having, a fundraiser after the BP oil spill. What was his connection like with an audience?
His humility was an amazing thing, and his shyness for a guy on a stage, and it was a big crowd, but he just did what he did so eloquently and so well. They were incredibly moved by the whole thing.
Well, for people who had never seen him, especially early on, he sort of looked like a Civil War veteran.
He did. That's very funny, Robin, because he looked like one of those guys that would play one of those Civil War battle remakes.
Right. There was always like a deep sadness in his eyes, but as you said, very, very shy, very kind. And the voice we've been talking about, it's been described as a weightless tenor. Let's listen to one of the songs from the new CD. It's called Every Day I Get the Blues.
Every day I get the blues. Every day I get the blues. Ain't anybody laughing?
Well, again, he went to Canada 66, 67, was granted amnesty 77. That's a big decade. And a lot of his own music he didn't perform. He gave it to other artists because he was up in Canada and couldn't perform it here. And by the way, speaking of his going to Canada, the cover of the CD is a painting Jesse did for his mother before he left. It looks like it's probably her, a sad woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a song on it that he wrote for her at that time. It's called Ghosts. Let's just listen a little to that. He re-recorded it for the CD.
She's standing in the airport. She's telling me goodbye. She's telling me she loves me. And there are teardrops in her eyes.
course, for people of a certain age, that evokes quite a time, you know, people trying to make decisions about their lives. But I'm just wondering, Jimmy Buffett, if he had not been absent for that critical decade, you know, might he have been in the Youngbloods or Crosby, Stills, Nash and Winchester? Or, you know, what might have been?
Well, I wish he would have joined the Coral Reefer Band. You know, I think he would have. He loved being so connected with Memphis music at that time. He may have been more likely to have gone to Macon and been in one of those one of those Phil Walden bands there, or to Nashville. And I think he would have found a comfort level there because Christopherson was there, Mickey Newberry, and I think Jesse would have wound up in that talent pool.
But he might have been better known. And and yet those who do know him just adore him. And here we have this gift, this unexpected gift, a posthumous CD. It's hard to listen to it and not hear echoes of something else. I'm thinking of the first cut, All That We Have Is Now.
Maybe that's the great thing about music, that it does last. And I feel lucky to be able to listen to that. But it's kind of hard to listen to, I got to tell you. Knowing all of that and knowing this was the swan song, but I'm happy that we were able to do it.
Well, you had a beautiful line in your liner notes. I will miss him, but the life and works of Jesse Winchester have not been capped. They're like an oil well gone wild on the floor of the Gulf.
I think he'll like that.
Yeah, and the CD is called A Reasonable Amount of Trouble, a title that comes from the Maltese Falcon, the 1940s movie.
Yeah.
And Humphrey Bogart used to say, I don't mind a reasonable amount of trouble. And Jesse used to quote that line, so I'm sure he'd love the one you wrote, does love the one you wrote. Jimmy Buffett, thank you so much for helping us remember Jesse Winchester.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
Well, it was springtime when we married. Here comes January. Bring on the ice and storm, 'cause we got love to keep us warm. But
Jeremy, I think we heard Jimmy Buffett struggle a little bit there.
Yeah.
I think there are lumps in a couple of throats. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Together in whatever weather, sunshine in the park, we'll tell ghost stories when it's dark and laugh to hide the fear.